Our next case this morning is Kimberly Santi v. Cook County, case number 11-1182. Mr. Kasson.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Luke Kasson. I represent Kimberly Passananti. Kim was a deputy director at the Sheriff's Department, and for roughly 18 years did a marvelous job. She began to develop some issues with her supervisor, Mr. Sullivan, ultimately was fired, filed suit in 2008. The first issue is a threshold issue, Your Honor. What we have asserted here is that there is the way the district court dealt with the Rule 50 motions was error. There was
Mr. Passananti, let me just ask you. The transcript indicates the documents were exchanged at page 381 of the transcript. Did you get a copy?
I did not, Your Honor.
Did you ask for a copy?
I wasn't aware that one was tendered.
The transcript reflects it.
That it was tendered, yes, to the court.
Did you ever ask whether anyone had been filed?
I believe Judge Darrow ordered the defendants to file it.
Did they file what had been handed to him in court?
They never filed
it. Did the court file it?
He did not. It did not. Hence, what we're left with, Your Honor, is this hole in the Rule 50 mechanism.
We know that a motion was ultimately filed, though, that the requirement that there be specific grounds stated is supposed to work for everybody's protection, but especially to preserve issues for the party making the motion when it's unsuccessful. The issues were presented. You had an opportunity to respond. I don't see any prejudice to you.
You've
got some important substantive issues to talk about.
I will address also, Your Honor. The issue on Rule 50A certainly precedes those issues on Rule 50B. And without we can't get to that timeliness issue unless we actually have a 50A motion. And regardless of, you know, whether there was no filing, there's no question about that, and there was no oral recitation of grounds. There was a query by the district court, and that was it. The other issue is whether there was a timely filing under Rule 50B. The court held that, in its opinion, that under Collins versus Illinois, there was a timely filing because there was never any judgment entered. That is absolutely true. The judgment wasn't entered until October 7th. However, when the jury rendered its verdict on the 10th of June, the typical procedure is that
We know what the typical procedure is. Is it your position that the district judge has absolutely no discretion and must enter judgment on a verdict no matter how unjustified or corrupt he might think it is?
No, I don't.
Then why don't you move on?
Mm-hmm. I think the issue is one of fairness, and there is a policy that militates towards the entry of judgment, at least in a timely manner. And what is a timely manner is certainly a discretionary issue. That discretion, I believe, has been abused.
And so, in your view, the result should be the summary affirmance of the $4.1 million judgment?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you move on to other issues?
In addition, the court also addressed the gender harassment claims. The gender harassment claims, first, the defendant argues quite directly that the plaintiff failed to make out a prima facie case. And I think there is significant precedent to indicate out of this court, actually, that once the matter goes to trial, the prima facie case falls away and is no longer at issue. That is also consistent with the Supreme Court's pronouncements in Ortiz. But in the only issue post-verdict is whether the record supports a claim for intentional discrimination. A recent pronouncement by this court in EEOC versus Management Hospitality, which was 666 F3rd 422, which was decided on January 9, 2012, the court said that if the plaintiff's allegations are on the line between what are considered merely annoyances and truly sexually harassing, then the verdict should be upheld.
Isn't that a hostile work environment principle, and this is a sex-based termination claim?
There are both in this claim. There's a harassment claim and a Section 1983 claim.
Mr. Kasson, I got to tell you, this is one of the most confused cases I have ever seen on appeal, and what you just said reflects more of that confusion. A hostile environment is actionable under both Title VII and Section 1983 when you've got state action. What we've got here are two distinct claims, one based on termination, one based on the hostile environment combined with the suspension and accusations leveled at your client. Both can be actionable under both Section 1983 and Title VII. Let me ask you, where did the how was the verdict form developed in this case?
The verdict form was developed. It was a what we considered a classic form. What we used, we agreed to with the defendants. It was a standard verdict form.
It is a recipe for confusion. Let me give you an example. Okay, you've got a verdict in your favor, and that comes with a lot of weight behind it. But frankly, I have trouble seeing much evidence that would allow a reasonable jury to find that after Sullivan's stroke and leave, the decision to terminate your client's employment was based on her sex. There was, as far as I can tell, no effort in the verdict form to break into different groups: damages for the abusive environment and related problems, and the later termination. Is that right?
I think that's correct. It does not break it out.
If we were to view the termination as not actionable here, if we were to agree with Judge Dara, but were to agree that the verdict should stand as to the abusive environment that your client was subjected to, what should we do?
The case should then be returned to the district court.
We've already had a – Sullivan can only be responsible for the hostile environment, right?
That is correct.
And the jury's already decided that the appropriate damages for that are $70,000 in compensatory and $30,000 in punitive damages against him, right?
That is correct.
County's not liable for punitives, right?
County's not liable for punitives.
Okay, so why not just reinstate it for a $70,000 verdict against the county?
Well, I guess the issue would be on the – if it went back on the hostile work environment, if this court were to find that there was sufficient evidence and went back down on that, the issue would be the apportionment of that. It would be subject to automatic remittitor because of the cap.
Well, not under 1983, though.
Not under 1983.
So, but we've got a jury finding that $70,000 is compensatory damages for the abusive environment. And why isn't that conclusive on that subject? That's a pretty good award.
Mm-hmm. And it may be, Your Honor. I would not actually dispute that, because of the way the verdict form reads. If it goes back down on the 1983,
on the abusive environment. Don't distinguish between Title VII and 1983. Distinguish between the termination and the abusive environment.
Understood. If it went back down on the abusive environment, I think the ultimate verdict would be limited to that amount.
What is the evidence of a sex-based termination?
Your Honor, I think that there were I know that there were quite a few instances where the where Kim herself testified that there were repeated references of an obscene nature to her.
It has to do with the hostile work environment claim. That there's no link between that evidence and her termination, so far as I can tell.
So as to the termination...
As to the termination itself, take out all the evidence of hostile work environment, unless you have some evidence linking that to her termination, that all goes on the hostile work environment claim.
Yes. The one issue that links, or the series of facts that links that up, is there was a statement by Sullivan indicating that he was going to have her fired. After she was... He ultimately had a stroke and left the unit. However, when she was, there was during the budget cycle, she had had a conversation with training director Carmelita Wagner, who indicated that she was going to have to take one for the sheriff. Shortly after the budget cycle during the occurred, and Alexis Herrera, who testified for the defendant, indicated that she was responsible for budgeting.
And the evidence before the jury showed that the sheriff's budget proposed to the county board included funding for plaintiff's position, right?
There was one budget document that did, yes.
Okay. And the county board ultimately said remove that, right?
The county, I think
remove
the sheriff,
the funding.
I think the sheriff's department indicated that they needed to reassess.
The county board insisted on further cuts.
Yes.
Okay. So how do we, given this, that the sheriff, when he had the opportunity to propose that as a cut, didn't take it, how do we conclude that there was that Sullivan's animus carried forward to the budget decision months later?
Because I think it was more than just an overall budget decision. She had Kim also had a conversation with Ms. Herrera. So she was aware of the situation with Mr. Sullivan. And there was she reported that she had had such a conversation.
Talk to Herrera?
Talk to Herrera.
Where did we find that?
I don't have the transcript site, Your Honor. I'll look for it. And I see my time is up, and I do want to reserve some time. But to finish the thought, Ms. Herrera, on cross-examination, had to admit that she had really, in the budget process, the only one who had lost her job was Kim. Thank you.
When you come back, I won't ask you now. I just want you to comment on the Ellerth and what she did in during the hostile environment episode.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Bacci?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Greg Vasey. I represent both the appellees in this case, Mr. Sullivan, and the Sheriff of Cook County. I think throughout this whole post-trial process, there's been attempts in the briefs up through this Court to imply or to try to establish that the district court somehow entered into looking at credibility determinations and things like that, which is simply not the case. The court applied the proper standards as to the sufficiency of the evidence, which is essentially a summary judgment standard. This is a case that should have been disposed of on summary judgment. Obviously, there was none filed. It preceded the trial, but we have the same issue here. There was simply as to both determination based on gender and the hostile work environment.
Could we talk about what was filed for a moment?
Yes.
The Rule 50A motion that you tendered to the court in trial?
Yes.
Did that ever show up in the court file or on the record on appeal?
There's no indication that it was in either.
How did that happen?
I couldn't tell you. I was not the trial attorney, but apparently, and it's in the appendix, the whole colloquy between the court, it was clearly tendered to the court. There's an indication in transcript pages 381 through 386, specifically on page 385, where, if you recall, the court is going through the motion, which obviously the court has. At page 385, there's an indication that, and again, I wasn't there, but there's an indication that the counsel
well,
for
if
the
you weren't,
claim,
I know what's in the record. If you can't elaborate on it,
well,
that's
he made
fine.
The statement that I
Let
hadn't
me ask
gotten.
You, was did the county ever file an alternative motion for a new trial, suggesting that maybe the damages were excessive here?
It never got to that point, Judge, because of the Rule 50B just dealt with the sufficiency of the evidence.
But you didn't try to protect your record by an alternative motion just in case, for example, we might find that there was some merit to this jury verdict?
My understanding is that could have been done subsequent to
an appeal? After an appeal?
No, in a remitted or type of motion.
The county thought that that motion could be filed if it lost on appeal?
No, not on appeal.
Okay.
If the court didn't grant this particular motion, the 50B motion.
Let me, if I could, ask you about the both you and the district court relied upon the Ellerth defense.
Yes.
I have a little trouble understanding how that would apply here, because we have tangible employment actions taken by Mr. Sullivan against this plaintiff, right?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor.
Suspension?
Testimony regarding.
She got suspended and demoted based on his false accusations, we must assume, right? Right?
I think there were more threats of that type of thing.
Are you saying she didn't get suspended and didn't get demoted?
I believe she got suspended prior to the allegations. I don't think it was all part of one transaction.
We've got a hostile environment claim here extending over many months.
Correct.
That included the suspension, the false accusation that she'd had sex with an inmate, the demotion. With that kind of tangible adverse employment action taken against the plaintiff by her supervisor, how does Ellerth apply?
Well, the parties in the court all agreed on the jury instruction.
I know. As I said, this is one of the most confused and confusing records I've ever seen, and that's part of it. Forget about the agreement. Because obviously the jury if an instruction was proper at all, the content of the instruction was proper, and the jury rejected it. So why would it be proper to give the instruction at all?
Well, I would agree with the court that those what you've talked about are tangible job actions. I don't know what the thought process was at that time, but the parties did reach an agreement that, for some reason, those tangible job actions were not related to the hostile work environment or the allegations of the hostile work environment.
Is that the agreement, or is that your supposition?
That would be my supposition.
Okay. And we had ample testimony that the stated policy and procedures for complaints were unrealistic, right? The plaintiff's case is replete with that evidence.
Her claim that she could not comply with the
right. It would have been pointless. As the county's lawyers kept emphasizing, she knew more about the complaint policy than anybody else in the in the department, and she knew it didn't work.
Well, I think that was the testimony, essentially saying that there's no reason for the sheriff to have a policy because somebody in her position wouldn't have to follow it, and then the sheriff would then not get the notice.
Well, we know it got to internal affairs, right? Do we have the Gallagher letter in the record anywhere?
I don't believe it was I think it was the subject of a stipulation, but I don't believe that the actual letter was entered into evidence.
Okay, counsel for the county was displaying it to everybody going over it in detail with the plaintiff, and it's not in the record?
I have not found any indication.
I'm going to ask plaintiff's counsel about this as well, but not right now, but I just want you to be ready to answer that. Okay. Can I ask you about the word bitch?
Sure.
Which is all over this case. Is it the county's position that that term is always gender neutral? That it can never be used to express hostility to women as a matter of law?
I think it's the county's position that it depends on the case or the circumstances.
Context matters.
Given case.
That's what we've said in many cases,
yes.
Right? And essentially every other circuit says in this kind of a case you let the jury decide. And here it went to the jury. Now we have an answer from them. Why shouldn't we accept that?
Because I believe in this particular case, the word was not, there was no evidence that it was being used in an animus towards women.
Was it ever used? There's no indication, there was never any defense here that Mr. Sullivan was sort of an equal opportunity abuser or cursor. We see that sometimes. So, and we see the evidence indicating it's used only at women. We don't see any evidence of comparable abuse of men, do we?
There was no evidence of that.
So, why wasn't the jury reasonable in concluding that this was evidence of a pervasively hostile environment under Mr. Sullivan's leadership?
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that it rose to the level of being pervasive, even if it was used on the occasions that
Plaintiff's testimony and the other witnesses' testimony was it was frequent. It was often accompanied by other epithets. Why isn't that reasonable? That's what we ask juries to decide.
Correct. I think the evidence in this record does not rise to the level of a hostile work environment as determined by this court in similar cases.
What's your best case?
And the cases that we found.
Pick two or three if you like.
The cases that we found that were similar, using the same type of language. We cited in our brief Gleason versus Mesereau, 118 F 3rd 1134, where the term bitchy was used, referred to female customers. Case of Galloway versus General Motors, 78 F 3rd 1164, plaintiff was called a sick bitch on numerous occasions, and an obscene gesture was directed to her while demanding, "Suck this bitch." Then the other cases where there's even more physical type of contact with the plaintiff, and that was still not found to be a hostile work environment.
Have you looked at case law from around the country on this?
Not in particular, no.
Okay. Let me ask you. You can read our cases to suggest that something more is needed, although that would put us in a minority position, a tiny minority among the circuits. Almost everybody else would say, absolutely, this goes to the jury. But if something more is needed to turn repeated degrading use of the term bitch and worse to the plaintiff and other women in the workplace, why would the accusation of sexual misconduct with an inmate and the arguably discriminatory discipline on the tampering incident and the suspension and demotion not add up to the something more needed to turn this into an actionable hostile environment?
Your Honor, I would say because there's nothing on the face of those acts that would allow a reasonable fact finder to say that was done because she's a woman.
Is there any term comparable to bitch that applies to men?
To men?
Yeah. That where you could say, no, that's really gender neutral, and we need to know about the context.
I would say none comes to mind.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Judge, or Your Honors, with respect to the specifically the termination, there certainly is no evidence that would connect that the resulting reduction in force that led to plaintiff's termination with her gender. And certainly no evidence put into the plaintiff's case in chief that would make that connection. The testimony of Alexa Herrera, which was offered by the sheriff's office, certainly showed that the layoff and the budget cut was made to plaintiff's position without the sheriff even weighing in on it. And the testimony by Ms. Herrera specifically was that she was not allowed to communicate with the sheriff's office and other employers regarding those cuts. So Your Honor was correct that the sheriff initially had that position in the budget, and it was removed by Ms. Herrera without even the sheriff's knowledge. So,
did the head count go down or up with those budget cuts, the actual head count?
That's unclear, Your Honor. I know there were some documents that were never placed in evidence, which I don't believe really are the subject.
But they were talked about in front of the jury, right? I mean, I've never seen anything like this, where the evidence presented to the jury is never actually admitted and put into the record, and the transcript repeatedly says things like, the exhibit is admitted.
It is a fairly difficult record to plow through. But there is no indication that I could see as far as what the ultimate number was. But again, that the plaintiff's position that the jury simply didn't believe Ms. Herrera doesn't point to any specific evidence that rebutted her testimony or impeached her in any way.
Can you help me out with this suggestion that the plaintiff had talked to Herrera? Was that in the transcript?
I did not see that or read that in the transcript. So with respect to the termination issue, again, there was nothing to rebut Ms. Herrera's testimony. I don't believe it's sufficient to just say that the jury didn't believe Ms. Herrera when there was no reason not to believe her. And the documentary evidence, which was never entered into evidence and was never challenged, the plaintiff never challenged the court as to whether that evidence was admitted. So really, in the end of the day, there really is nothing for the plaintiff to rely on regarding her termination being the subject of gender discrimination. And again, with the Ellerth-Farragher defense, there was no objection to the instruction. The instructions are laid out in the briefs. I won't go through them for time. But 305B was the instruction. There was no objection to it. there was no argument in the response to the 50B motion that it wasn't that the county should not have been able to use that defense. That argument did not pop up until much later. So again, on both of those issues, really the overarching principle is there's no evidence to support the gender discrimination under 1983 for Mr. Sullivan or the sheriff, and the evidence regarding the hostile work environment, it's the county's position that based on the law in this circuit, that the court would essentially be lowering the standard
to fit
the facts of this case. Thank you.
Mr. Cassidy. Yes. Minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. To answer a couple of the questions, the Gallagher letter was Exhibit 1. It was admitted into evidence, and it was sent back to the jury.
Is it in the appellate record?
It is, in fact, in the appellate record also. There are a couple of issues with the Appley's presentation, Ms. Herrera did in fact testify that she had spoken to Sheriff Dart's budget people. So it is not accurate to say that she did not consult with any of the other Sheriff's Department employees, because she admitted that she in fact did. That's at the trial transcript at 273.
What difference does that make?
Because I think it corrects the assertion that Ms. Herrera had no contact with anybody from the Sheriff's Department. Therefore,
right, but that's not a link that you can use to show gender discrimination in this plaintiff's firing.
I do not disagree that that's not the
okay.
What's
tying the plaintiff talked to Herrera?
The plaintiff, I can't find the trial transcript.
I didn't see it.
So I'd have to look back at the trial transcript itself. But I asked the question. So I have a pretty good recollection of what it was. And but be that as it may, the Ellerth issue, I think, there was significant evidence throughout the course of the trial, not only from Ms. Passanini, but from three or four other witnesses, which included other women who were in the unit who filed complaints and nothing ever happened to them.
Except that they were told not to put things on effing paper.
Exactly the point. And they were told that repeatedly, and Kim was told to tell everybody just that also, to stop, have them stop putting complaints on paper, which is antithetical to the policy. If no one can take advantage of there being a policy, there is no policy. I see my time is up. Thank you.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.